Case number 23-1140. Citizens for Constitutional Integrity of the Balance, Mr. Santos Fiore of the Balance. Mr. Pepin Appel for the Balance, Ms. Clark for the Appellate.
Morning, counsel. Mr. Pettinato, please proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Jared Pettinato, and I represent Citizens for Constitutional Integrity. With me at counsel table is Dean Michael Meltzner, who served as counsel for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund in the Lampkin v. Connor case. I reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. To enforce our sacred right to vote, Article 3 standing does not require proof of how the Census Bureau would apportion seats on remand. No plaintiff in an malapportionment case has ever proven the apportionment that a legislature or an agency would do if the plaintiff prevailed in court. The district court required that of Citizens, but it did that, although the Supreme Court rejected that argument directly in 1962. It held it would not be necessary to decide whether appellant's allegations will ultimately entitle them any relief in order to hold that they have standing to seek it. That's the Baker versus Carr case. Article 3 recognizes standing for malapportionment claims as long as the plaintiff presents an apportionment with a closer approximation to the legal requirements. Citizens' calculations show that it's possible for them to obtain new seats, and that establishes their Article 3 standing.
So what would be the outcome if the court required that the report be withdrawn if the people are all serving?
Well, Your Honor, that's a good merits question, and that is a very good remedies question, that the parties would brief, that they would investigate the facts of how that would work, and that's far down the line. For now, as long as this court has the power on redressability, and as long as exercising that power has some possibility of giving citizens their seats back, that satisfies the requirement of redressability. And here, simply setting aside and vacating the report would require applying the 2010 census, and that would give New York and Pennsylvania their seats back.
Why would it require defaulting back to the 2010 census?
That is the action. I think it's the action against non-smoking case. That is the practice of this court. Vacatur, when a court sets aside under the Administrative Procedure Act 5 U.S.C. 7062, that requires the prior order to restore, to spring back into effect. That is how vacatur works.
There's a lot that's happened in the interim, though, that is predicated on the apportionment that occurred. That would be quite something to take us back to before any of this happened.
Yes, Your Honor, a lot of water has gone under the bridge. We've been litigating this case as quickly as we can. We could not bring it before the Census Bureau finished its apportionment. We brought it after that, and we've been moving apace. It's not uncommon in malapportionment cases for them to take a while. The Supreme Court has voluminous malapportionment cases that are still ongoing. They addressed some this term. They issued opinions last term. But these are all ultimately remedies questions that we can address at that appropriate phase.
No, I was just going to say, you seem to not believe that she had to put forward any facts with respect to New York or Pennsylvania, their voter registration, their ID requirements, and whether, any of that was going to file to the reduction clause. So I'm just trying to get a sense again of, your remedy, your outcome with respect to this case.
Well, Your Honor, because we have proven a procedural right and that arises from our zone of interest, arguably within the zone of interest of the statutes that where our injury is, we only have to prove some possibility that the remedy could restore and cure the injury. And we have mathematical proof that if the Census Bureau did their reapportionment based on some analyses of the data, that it could restore seats to New York and Pennsylvania, or both. And that is what differentiates this case from the Cantor case, from the Franklin case, from even the Shero case. Those situations did not have this mathematical proof. They did not establish the possibility that there was any possibility
as I understand your causation argument, though, the way it was articulated in the briefing, as I conceptualized it, was that this seems causation straightforward. There's a report, and then at the end of the day, at least in two instances, we lost seats.
Exactly. Yeah.
But would that be equally true if then there's a report, but then the legal wrong you're complained of, if corrected by your own estimation, would actually result in a worse scenario?
That this is all in some manner speculative, as in the Duke Power case, Your Honor. And that is the Baker versus Carr case again.
So I'm trying to take it out of speculation. So I'm just saying, let's just suppose that you have a case. Oh, let's just take this case. Suppose that you actually have evidence and you do the statistical analysis and your expert comes back and says, if we assume the legal wrong to be what you assume the legal wrong to be, which is to say the Census Bureau was supposed to adjudicate whether voter ID laws are invalid and assimilate that into the report, it turns out actually that the jurisdictions that you represent would be worse off. Would you say that causation is still established because, look, all you need to know is there was a report, and after that report was filed and an apportionment was done, we're worse off?
Yes, Your Honor. That is all that causation requires. But for causation, the report caused the aggrievement that comes out of 5 U.S.C. 702 of the Administrative Procedure Act, the data processing case, and the Ted Cruz for Senate case.
So even if correcting, by your own estimation, correcting the legal wrong that you're complaining of would put you in an even worse position, you'd still say causation is established.
Well, we can't prove that it would put us in a worse position.
But I'm saying that's the only evidence you have. If you do the report, you even file it.
All that Article 3 requires is but-for causation, whether the report caused our injury. And it did. Here it did. It is undisputed that that's what it did. Now, if the Census Bureau undergoes this process, and it turns out that it hurts us, that would be unfortunate. But that doesn't change our threshold, our ability to get over the threshold into court.
So you don't have to show that the legal wrong you complained of caused the...
Correct, Your Honor. Let's look at the Lujan case and the Brown case discuss procedural injury based on failure to complete NEPA when building a dam. And the court said, of course, you have procedural injury, a procedural right, and you can challenge that because they didn't complete the environmental analysis. So it could happen that when the agency goes back and analyzes the dam, that it turned out worse for the plaintiffs. They could end up taking the plaintiff's property to build the dam. They were nearby, and that is entirely possible that it could work out worse. But the Supreme Court did not, recognize a procedural right as long as there is some possibility of a remedy, even if there is also a possibility that it might not turn out in your favor.
How do you articulate specifically the procedural right that you have here given to you by either the statute or by Section 2?
So the zone of interest test gives us the procedural right. That's the Pena case by this court. That's also the Lexmark case. And we fall well within the zone of interest for Article 1 of the Constitution, the 14th Amendment, Section 2, for the Census Bureau statutes, and for Section 209, which requires the Census Bureau to perform all of the constitutional requirements and references the 14th Amendment, Section 2 specifically. The procedure itself is the calculation of denials and abridgments, which the Census Bureau did not do, has never done, and has stated in a letter to us that it would not do. So that is the procedure that we are seeking. And because we're within the zone of interest, that gives us this procedural right. And the procedural right is what allows us the lower burden of proving redressability. It also allows us a lower burden of causation. We only need to prove that there are two connections. And this is Your Honor's STP case, the Surface Transportation case from, or Surface Transportation Board case from last year, where you have to prove two connections, a connection between the agency, between the legal flaw and the agency action, and between the agency action and the harm. So that's another way to prove causation here. There's really lots of ways to prove causation. The district court wanted us to prove it in a particular way, but we think that we don't have to prove it in that particular way. We could have proven it in lots of other ways. Here, the most straightforward, the easiest way to prove causation is but-for causation. But for the report, we would not have suffered this injury, and that is, that proves causation.
Even if the Census Bureau doesn't allocate the seat?
Even if, in the long run, the Census Bureau doesn't allocate the seats, we can't prove what they're going to do in the future. That's the whole basis for procedural injury. That's the catch-22 from the tribal case, from the Ogallala Sioux case that Chief Judge Garland ruled upon. So that it presents if the agency doesn't do the analysis, it's hard to prove the injury from the analysis that they didn't do. And so you need to have some way to open that up, and that's what this procedural rights do.
Do my colleagues don't have additional questions for you at this point? We'll give these a nod for a vote.
All right, thank you, Your Honor.
May I please support Sarah Clark for the United States. Plaintiff has not met its standing burden. Not only has it failed to grapple with the legal and practical barriers to its ability to obtain redress, it also hasn't shown standing even within the four corners of its hypothetical scenarios. So I just want to start with redress. I mean, we just heard a lot about causation, and I have plenty of responses to that, but I want to refocus on redressability. Judge Childs, I think your question elicited a response that, you know, this is really a merits question, you know, whether or not anything will happen in the real world, that's not for now. And that's incorrect. I think it's important that this court consider that the relief that plaintiff is asking for cannot redress its injury. And I think it tries to run away from that analysis by saying, we have a procedural right, you just don't even need to think about it. And obviously we disagree that there is a procedural right here, and it's certainly not correct that you just ignore redressability. I can just dig a little bit deeper on the procedural issue.
So why would drawing the report and the statement have some impact?
A few reasons, Your Honor. So for one, of course, even if the Census Bureau were to be faced with an order from this court that says the last report is invalid, that doesn't mean that New York suddenly has an additional representative or that, you know, Texas's two additional representatives just walk out of the Capitol. So there is no kind of real world effect in that sense. And I would also point to the Supreme Court's decision in Franklin, their discussion of the kind of chain of causation between the secretary's report and the president's statement. So, of course, there they were observing that there was probably going to be, you know, if the report changed, the president's statement changed. I just want to distinguish this case and say that it's far from obvious here, just because this is a different and more complicated issue. This is not a kind of mechanical correction. This is a intensely judgment-laden analysis that plaintiff wants the Census Bureau to engage in. And I think that brings us back to the redressability.
I mean, that might be true. Those may be good arguments on the merits as to why you can't expect the Census Bureau to undertake the kinds of legal assessments that the theory would put forward. But for purposes of standing, we have to assume the legal merits of the theory that's being put forward.
Yes, but you don't have to assume that the Census Bureau has authority that it doesn't have, or that the court can issue orders it doesn't have authority to issue. So, for example, one sort of fact the plaintiff doesn't grapple with is that the statute directs the secretary to send the tabulation of total population in its report, not some sort of adjusted count. So setting aside the practical difficulties of gathering this information, there are legal barriers as well, and those are rightfully considered in the redressability analysis, not just at the merits.
Well, but for redressability purposes, too, we assume that the plaintiffs are going to win on the merits.
We assume that they're going to win on the merits, but that doesn't mean that the court has any powers that plaintiff posits they might have. There are still practical limits. So if a plaintiff were to come in and say, you know, I have an injury, it will be redressed by you, you know, I think I should be the Secretary of Defense, my injury will be redressed when you enjoin the President to appoint me the Secretary of Defense, I think it would be quite reasonable to say that's not redress, we cannot. So even if you're right on your sort of legal theory of you should be the Secretary of Defense, that doesn't get you there. And I think it's quite proper to consider that at the standing stage, even if it could also be relevant at the merit stage.
So the district court can do any of this, right?
The district court sort of said, okay, we're in the world of your scenarios, accepting, you know, that the Census Bureau could do something of the nature you're asking. Even then, you haven't shown that you would be better off, that your injury has been caused by the report. And I think, you know, they relied on causation, but for many of the reasons that, you know, it wouldn't be redressed by a different report. So they focused, I think, rightly on plaintiffs' reliance on their scenarios that involve Wisconsin, right? So plaintiffs' theory, one of their theories, is that voter ID requirements require adjustments to total populations because they're denials or abridgments. They allege in their complaint, and they reiterated in argument in district court, that states other than Wisconsin have these offending laws and that adjustments would need to be made. Their scenarios 3 and 4, which are the only two that benefit the plaintiffs that they allege, the members that they allege are injured, include Wisconsin only. They don't take into effect any other states, and therefore they tell us nothing, frankly, about what an apportionment might look like if voter ID laws across the country were taken into account. So there's just no way of knowing what would happen. And I think this court's decision in National Law Center versus Cantor is quite instructive. That case involved a challenge to the Census Bureau's method for counting homeless persons during the census. And the panel observed, you know, you haven't shown us that you would be better off if a count was done according to how you think it should be done. And in fact, you haven't said how you think you want it to be done anyway. And that is also akin to plaintiff here. They say, you know, we don't know how the Census Bureau should do this. We don't know all the states that have denials or abridgments. That's the Census Bureau's problem. And yet they want to take the position that they would be better off. And that's exactly the argument that this court rejected in Cantor.
I think that the response to that would be, right, when you don't have any idea how it's going to turn out, we can't be expected to forecast the future. And so the Bureau, in our view, and the legal merits of it just yet to be tested, should have done X. X was never done. So it's not incumbent upon us to say how it would turn out if X was done. We just have to point out that there's this flaw, and that's enough to get us home.
Right, that's not enough to get them home. Of course, that doesn't sort of free them from the requirements of showing Article 3 standing. And if it did, I think, you know, potentially the plaintiffs in Cantor could have been in a different position. We do expect plaintiffs to, you know, allege at the motion to dismiss stage and later prove that causation and redressability actually exists. And I think you see in their briefs that they, you know, recognize that their scenarios don't really get them there. That's, I think, why they lean so heavily on their procedural argument and on the argument that, you know, we can't possibly know, therefore, you should just say we have.
Wouldn't you have a situation in which the only, what the Census Bureau did is give a report that's blank, and somebody wants to say, boy, that's not what you're supposed to do. And then the apportionment just stays the same because there's no change in it because the report just doesn't do anything. That someone says, that's not what the report is supposed to do. It's supposed to do something. Now, I have no idea what the report would do if it were done. I'm just telling you that a blank page is not a report. What would you say about causation of this?
Well, I guess one thing that I would flag is just it's not clear that we would be in the world of nothing changed because the president has his own independent statutory obligation to transmit population totals and apportionment to Congress. And that's actually what, you know, sort of.
Well, suppose the president just says, okay, I'm just, because the report is blank, I usually rely on this report because the report is blank. I'm just going to, you know, stand over the same stuff that was in place now. That's the portion.
So someone
comes along and says, the president just relied on a blank piece of paper. The paper had to have something on it. And the challenge is, yeah, paper had to have something on it. And what would you say about causation?
Right. So setting aside maybe cause of action issues, I think a plaintiff would need to come in and say, Census Bureau, if you had actually counted the total population of the states, or, you know, if you had actually put the total populations of the state down on paper and passed that to the president, we actually would have gained a representative. So they would show that there would be some sort of difference in the real world for them if the Census Bureau had complied with, you know, whatever plaintiff view views its legal obligation to be in a given case. So they have, I just wanted to emphasize that they do have to connect the challenged conduct to the injury. So we don't agree with their suggestion that causation is satisfied just by saying, oh, the report said minus one. They need to make a connection between what they're saying the Census Bureau has done wrong, which is, for them is not applying this adjustment, and their injury. And the way they try to get out of that, obviously, is by saying procedural injury, we don't have to do any of that. And so I'll just say briefly, this is not kind of procedural injury that triggers the sort of softened causation or redressability burdens, right? They try to fit it into that framework by saying this is the process that the Census Bureau should have engaged in. But the kind of classic procedural injury is, you know, environmental impact report, letting me comment on a rule, things that are adjacent to the substantive decision. Here they're challenging the substantive decision. And if it were correct that sort of any process that a defendant does is sufficient to bring it within the more lenient procedural injury world, I think a whole raft of cases look very different, including the Supreme Court's line of cases, Franklin, Utah, this court's decision in Cantor. I think those would all look different if the mere indication of a process was enough to bring it into that world. Of course, we don't think that even if we're in the procedural injury world that they met that more lenient burden because it's part of some of the redressability issues that we were talking about earlier.
You also suggest that they shouldn't be here anyway because Section 209 is not the, they're not a proper party in that regard.
Right. So if we were to get to the cause of action issues, we don't think that they fit within that section at all. They don't have a cause of action under Section 209 because they're not a person within the meaning of that provision, and also because they're not challenging, they're not aggrieved by the use of any statistical method. So that provision is just, they're not within it. They can't rightly bring a claim under it, and it's designed for a totally different set of circumstances.
But you used OnStar too, which involved a state non-organization.
So there has been, I believe, a three-judge district court panel that rejected states' attempts to bring such a claim, saying you're not one of the kind of listed persons. So that's certainly one of their problems under Section 209. And then obviously they have the problem of not being aggrieved by the use of any statistical method. I think there they would say, we're challenging the report is an activity, the activity is related to statistics because the Census Bureau uses statistics, and that's just not, I think, consistent with the plain meaning of the section.
I'm trying to understand who could ever bring a Section 2 case more constructive. Let's suppose state passes a law that says that anyone who's on food stamps can't vote. We just don't think that people should be able to vote. And so these, let's say, just for the sake of the hypothetical, Wisconsin passes that law, and they're the only state that passed it. And these plaintiffs bring the same lawsuit and say, we know exactly how many people are on food stamps in Wisconsin. There's a report since it's had that information. But they elected to say that any of those people's rights. They have standing, they have redressability.
I think they would still have, frankly, the same redressability problems that go to the Census Bureau's ability to do this kind of analysis in the first place. But those that
like the this, that's not rocket science. Talking to the Census Bureau. Stamps.
Well, that obviously wouldn't resolve the limits on their ability to kind of transmit. So for one, it wouldn't resolve their limits and their ability to transmit information to the president. They have to report on the total population. Also, what plaintiff envisions, and I think even in that hypothetical, what the plaintiff would be saying is the Census Bureau has an obligation to survey all 50 states, use its judgment to decide what state laws constitute abridgments or denial. So maybe in this hypothetical, they would ultimately determine it was only this Wisconsin food stamp law, and then determine with precision how many people were subject to that. So within the world of kind of scenarios of, you know, scenario three, scenario two, I think a plaintiff in that situation would be better able to show, you know, okay, if you only remove these people, recalculate, do you think we're better off? They would satisfy kind of that route, but they still would not, I don't think, be able to overcome the sort of broader issues with requiring the Census Bureau to do this. It's not within
on that's been in that scenario that would have played out, then the case couldn't be disposed of as the district court disposed of this.
I think it still could be. I think the causation and redressability inquiry. Oh, so sorry. I guess in that they examine the specific scenario, yes, I think that's a different sort of approach to it. Obviously, we think both would be correct and both would be sufficient to defeat plaintiff standing.
Both
being the sort of broader redressability problems and the specific.
No, that's not what the district court did here.
Right, and the, versus the specific, what have you alleged? We see that that isn't even enough taken at face value to get you over the causation and possibility. So maybe that particular issue could be handled better in a different case, could be handled more precisely. That's obviously not what we have here because they haven't even kind of narrowed the analysis sufficiently.
I'm confused. But you're saying that even in the hypothetical where everyone on food stamps in the state is great, that there will be no redress vote.
In a suit brought against the Census Bureau, I think that's correct. That's not to say that there is no
record case against.
I'm not sure, Your Honor. It's not clear because of the way that the production clause and the statutory scheme exist. There's no obvious thing answer to that question.
Myself, I have a problem when you make an argument that with respect to a specific constitutional provision, you can't articulate for me how any plaintiff would ever have standing to enforce it.
Well, enforce it is a different question, right? That one of the issues is, you know, who is the correct defendant? And of course, this court doesn't need to go so far. It doesn't need to sort of have a sweeping theory of the reduction clause and who might be able to bring the case. It's sufficient to say that this plaintiff here has not satisfied the requirements of standing. And, you know, we don't know if anyone else, you know, we don't know what circumstances might be sufficient. But this plaintiff has not met the requirements of Article
3. We don't know what defendant could redress, but we don't know what government entity could provide any sort of redress to this specific constitutional provision in the text.
Well, again, I don't know that this court needs to opine on that necessarily or to speak categorically on that issue. I mean, what we have before us is.
But it's relevant to whether we should agree with you with respect to kind of how to frame what the Census Bureau's powers are, what our powers are, what we have ordered the Census Bureau to do.
So I guess another way to look at that issue could be through the lens of I guess timing, really, timing in relation to the power of the Census Bureau. So to contrast, in, say, Franklin, Utah, some of these other cases, those cases were resolved before the new apportionment took effect. So I think that's another sort of barrier to redressability here that I wasn't sort of emphasizing enough earlier. That, I think, also would be sort of sufficient to block redressability and would not require sort of opining more broadly on the scope of the Census Bureau's authority. I think the bottom line, though, is plaintiffs can't obtain the relief that they're asking for. They can't get redress for the injury that they have asserted and relied on. And so there's just no Article III controversy here.
I mean, we could assume that you're wrong on all your broader arguments about addressability vis-a-vis the Census Bureau and still affirm on the district court's rationale, which is to say, yeah, you can bring a suit against the Census Bureau. Yeah, suppose state adopts poll tax. And if you have to, and the whole purpose of the poll tax is the purpose of poll tax. And there should be some reduction as redress for the poll tax. But if you have a plaintiff who's showing suffers from the same flaw that the district court identified, it may well be that the theory could still work. It could still be against the Census Bureau and still go forward. But if the proof isn't there that they'd actually be better off, the scenario with the math happened under which they'd be better off, and the district court's narrow rationale would be enough to carry the day.
That's correct. That certainly would be sufficient to affirm the district court's decision here. I mean, we would obviously suggest that the court shouldn't embrace plaintiff's theory that the Census Bureau is the correct entity to sue, even in that sort of more limited decision. But I agree with Your Honor, that would be sufficient to affirm the dismissal on standing grounds of plaintiff's
suit. And the reduction clause says that apportionment shall be reduced, doesn't say who, and then there's no enabling statute with respect to the Census Bureau.
Exactly. There's no constitutional, there's no language in the reduction clause or in any statute that assigns this responsibility to any particular government actor.
And you're not taking a position on who that government actor is.
Correct.
But you
know, so 150 plus years later, we still don't know.
That's correct, John. To the extent it's any, comfort, I don't want to take myself too far off course, but I think what we know from the history is that to the extent the drafters of the 14th Amendment had a vision about who would do this, they thought that it would be Congress making these adjustments. Of course, again, that is sort of aside from...
But Congress can't do anything without that. I mean, when the 18th census, 70th census, they talk about it in the briefs. I don't know if anyone attached to the briefs the actual form. But the actual forms that census takers use, had a column where they asked them not to just, how much land you have, et cetera. It asks, has your right to vote shed?
Right.
The census put the position in that, well, we didn't even really tell our people to really ask that because we felt like we couldn't really adjudicate, whether somebody's right to vote had been British or not. And so we just didn't even really collect the information. And I think that maybe it was randomly done in some places, but not systematically done. As far as I know, that one time in 1870 was one and only time the census asked the question.
Right. I think that history just underscores sort of the lack of fit between what plaintiffs want and what the Census Bureau does and can do. I mean, again, I think Congress envisioned that it would be the one making the changes, and its one attempt to sort of do this through the census was not successful. So I think that
the Census Bureau doesn't, they're the ones who are supposed to be counting. So it's So who better to count how many of the everyones were denied their right to vote?
Right. The Census Bureau is certainly the expert at counting the number of people in the United States. They're not the expert at evaluating voting rights laws or voting rights violations. As the Census Bureau sort of informed plaintiff before this suit even started, you know, talk to the Department of Justice, talk to the Civil Rights Division. They're the kind of experts in terms of voting rights violations. So it's not something that the Census Bureau does or is well-positioned to do at all. They count the total number of people in the United States, and that's what, you know, that's what they transmit, of course, to the president when they send along their population.
So we should just kind of deduce that is this more of a ministerial act and just count the report, don't do any analysis?
I guess I'm not saying necessarily that it's ministerial, but I don't think anything would hinge on that sort of difference in this case. I'm just saying the type of task that they do is very, very different from the type of task that a plaintiff thinks they should be engaging in.
No additional questions? Okay. Thank you, counsel. Depend on only 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. There's a lot there. I'm going to try to cover as much as I can. First of all, this is what the framers said about whose responsibility is. The census taker will find it necessary to ascertain who were capacitated to vote. That is the Congressional Globe, 39th Congress, first session, on page 29 of our reply brief. This is the Constitution that we are expounding upon, and that is an important obligation that the framers assigned in passive voice so that they could make sure that everybody had a responsibility to implement it. Shall be reduced is passive voice in the Bart, I forget the exact Bartweiler case, I think is the Supreme Court said that means the actor is not quite important. And there, the framers were intending a broad implementation of the 14th Amendment, Section 2. So the Census Bureau recognized themselves in 1870 that it was their obligation, and they have not done it in 150 years. We've proven that it would change seats, that there is some possibility that it would change seats. And the district court never addressed that possibility. They never looked at our procedural rights to figure out if that was enough, because I expect because they knew that was enough. They didn't look at it because they made logical fallacies. They said, oh, the only procedural rights are public participation rights. And we know that from the Summers case. But that's not accurate, because the Japan whaling case is a procedural right that the Lujan case recognized. And in that case, the Secretary of Commerce was deciding whether to issue sanctions against Japan. There was no conceivable public participation in that. So the district court is wrong on its procedural right, and so there's really on whether we have procedural rights, and we've proven at least some possibility. It's possible also that the abridgment, I see him over time, that the abridgment and the denials that we've identified are maybe the only ones that the Census Bureau will do. We don't know, but that's possible. We have a blank sheet of paper. I see him out of time. Your Honor, the Supreme Court recognized that we all took oaths to support, to protect, and defend the Constitution, despite political thickets and mathematical quagmires. We request the court to reverse and to remand the case for further proceedings.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel. We'll take the case under submission.